It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets is 888 pages long. It begins with a la mode and addiction and ends with zuppa inglese. The entries in between are fascinating. The woman who made them all work is Dara Goldstein.
One of my favorite entries in the book is the history of confetti, which is such a pallid shadow of what it once was. You know, we throw paper now.
Right.
But originally, it was candied nuts or candied seeds. It was a sign of status. It was very expensive to do. Also a sign of fertility, or the presumed fertility of the couple and wishing them to procreate well.
A look at sweetness in all kinds of ways this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The Oxford University Press does not know how to skim over a subject. Its latest project is encyclopedic. It begins with a la mode, then addiction, and 888 pages of small type later. It ends with zalibia, an ancient Iranian pastry, and zuppa inglese. This is the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets, and you can't flip through it without stopping to read an entry, say on bird's milk. The person who made all this information work is Dara Goldstein. As editor, she brought together the works of food historians, neuroscientists, cooks, philosophers, chemists, art experts, and scholars of every stripe. Dara, welcome.
I'm so glad to talk to you, Lynn.
Dara, I imagine that pulling this together with all of these contributors had to be like herding cats.
It was a bit like herding cats, but since we've always had cats, I'm used to herding them. And I have great technique.
So you have this 888 pages that are full of everything, you know, sugar science, baking techniques, death, sex, politics. But is there an ongoing story here? Do you see a link between all of these, other than sweet?
Yes. Sugar is what ties it all together, or the idea of the sweet. But to me, the book is really a compendium of human desire, sort of a cultural history of desire for things that are sweet and what it has caused in the world, in both the realm of pleasure and also of pain.
Some examples?
Well, I always would like to go to pleasure first, and those are the beautiful confections that have been created over the years and throughout the world, not just with sugar, but with honey and with other forms of sweeteners. And then we think about how sugar, because it's so malleable in its different forms, has been used to create gorgeous sculptures. And we can think about art and representations of sweet things in art. And language, too, the terminology and the words we use every day for our loved ones, sugar and honey and sweetie pie. But then we get to the dark side, the slavery, the plantations, the sugar barons, the problems with what some people consider addiction to sugar and the health problems that result.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought was, you know, it occurred to me as I was reading through all of this material or trying to, is why do you think that sweets are so tied to celebrations, not just in the Western world, but it seems in most of the world?
Part of it has to do with the fact that we, evolutionarily speaking, have been drawn to the sweet. Those things that have ripeness and have sugar in them will give us energy and they'll enable us to survive. And so we celebrate survival with sweet things. And the ritual foods that are used, if you think about Ramadan, for instance, and having sweet dates to break the fast, or you think of the Jewish New Year and dipping apples in honey, or at funerals too, where you have dishes like kalivah, which are grain, and they are usually sweetened, it becomes part of our collective memory. And so throughout different religions and different cultures, sweet things signify a continuity.
Hey, I'm thinking, you rarely leave a wedding without some sort of little favor to take home, and it's usually something to do with sweets.
It is, and that's actually one of my favorite entries in the book, is to think about the history of confetti, which is such a pallid shadow of what it once was. You know, we throw paper now.
Right.
But originally, it was candied nuts and or candied seeds. It was a sign of status. It was very expensive to do. Also a sign of fertility, or the presumed fertility of the couple, and wishing them to procreate well. And then during the 18th century, these little bits of confetti, because they were so expensive, were made of plaster. And there's this wonderful passage when Goethe went to Rome during carnival season, and he saw people's suit coats battered with plaster that had erupted against their coats, and they were covered in dust, and some of them had to wear wire masks to protect their faces.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, the spirituality entry was very interesting to me, about this idea that sugar high, that happiness, that feeling we get when we eat sugar, and how that figured into religious rituals.
Yes, and you also think of that Matthew Arnold phrase about sweetness and light, and the idea of purity and a kind of transcendence. And I remember in graduate school reading about the Russian saints and their lives, and if you were that saintly, when you died, a sweet smell was supposed to emanate from the body instead of the smell of decay. Huh. So it is very closely tied up with ideas of a better, other world.
So interesting. What's your favorite entry in the book?
Oh, it's like choosing a favorite child or a favorite cat. It's hard to say, but I really like the one on unusual uses of sugar, because I learned so much from it. For instance, I had no idea beyond the kitchen that sugar was used as a preservative. I obviously make jam, and we know that if you add sugar, things won't spoil so rapidly. But scientists have found that if you take waterlogged timbers from medieval times that are starting to rot or have rotted already, and suspend them in a 67% sugar solution, then it creates a kind of impermeable barrier and the bacteria can't get in. So they've been able to use sugar to help preserve architectural monuments.
That's amazing.
It is. And they're making fabric now from sugar, taking green tea that has been lightly sweetened, and the sugar attracts the bacteria, so it collects on top and forms a thick kind of raft on top, which they can lift off and dry, and then sew and cut into various patterns. And it's a kind of bio-couture. And I think what fascinated me most, and I have the hardest time wrapping my own head around, is 3D printing with sugar. So early on, they were using sugar and extruding it and making all kinds of nifty little sculptures. But now they're using it to build artificial organs. So they grow living cells on this sugar solution that they've put through the 3D printer to create fibers that mimic blood vessels. And then the sugar is dissolved once the cells have grown on it, and interconnected channels are left behind. So the idea is that one day the sugar we eat could be used to create the organs that help to digest it. So it's this beautiful circle.
How fascinating.
Yeah.
Dara, the breadth of the book is really stunning. Congratulations, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Dara Goldstein is the Wilcox B. and Harriet M. Adsit Professor of Russian at Williams College and Editor-in-Chief of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. Now, you can find an excerpt from the book about the history of confetti on the website, splendidtable.org. You can also find some of our favorite sweet recipes, from frozen lemon meringue and little French fudge cakes to Christina Tozzi's addictive cornflake chocolate chip marshmallow cookies. That's splendidtable.org. the world has always had its share of gay icons. Look no further than James Beard. But recently, a new gay food icon has rolled into town and has been strewing rainbow sprinkles. Douglas Quint and his partner Brian Petroff started the Big Gay Ice Cream Truck in 2009, which morphed into two stores and now a book. Big Gay Ice Cream, Saucy Stories and Frozen Treats, Going All the Way with Ice Cream. Douglas talks to our correspondent, David Leet.
Welcome to the show, Douglas.
Ahem, hello.
So let's start at the very beginning of this incredible journey, Dorothy. Mm-hmm. How did the Big Gay Ice Cream Truck and also shop begin?
Yeah, long before the tornado took us away.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting my doctorate at the CUNY Grad Center, and it was a lot of work. You know, getting a doctorate's not easy. You have to study, and you have to play your instrument. You have to do recitals. The doctorate was going to be in bassoon performance, just so you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the winter leading up to my final semester, I thought, I'm going to do something strange this summer. It's not going to have anything to do with music. It's not going to have anything to do with studying. And it's going to have something to do with New York. And it's going to be a summer job like I've never had. I always went to music camps and things like that. So the opportunity to have an ice cream truck appeared suddenly on Facebook through a friend of mine who had been driving an ice cream truck. So I thought, well, that's weird. And I mentioned the whole thing to Brian, and Brian said, yeah, that's weird. Do it. And that's kind of how it all started.
And the name, the Big Gay Ice Cream Truck, came about because how?
Well, that came about because I wanted to tell my friends on Facebook what was going on to sort of have them come along for the ride. And we didn't have a name for this Facebook group, and I just called it the Big Gay Ice Cream Truck because it sounded like it was going to be a big gay ice cream truck. And we figured we'd do some sort of name later. We'd figure it out later. But so many people started joining the group just to see I'm a fan of the Big Gay Ice Cream Truck in their feed that we realized we had found our name. So when we actually brought a truck out onto the street, people flipped out. They didn't realize we were serious about it. I didn't realize that either.
Now, why soft serve ice cream?
Well, soft serve found us. Because the ice cream truck can only serve vanilla and chocolate ice cream. You know, there's only those two handles, basically, on the right. Ice cream truck. So that's how the premise of getting a different topping menu started for the truck. Because we looked at it, and it was chocolate sprinkles and rainbow sprinkles and cherry dip and chocolate dip. And those are all great things. But those have all been on the ice cream truck menu since, you know, the diesel engine was invented.
Right.
So we wanted to redo it. Or at least boost it up a level. And so one of the combinations that kind of proved popular was dulce de leche and crushed up Nilla wafers. It's the cone that would become the B. Arthur.
So what are some of your other bestsellers?
Well, the very best seller is called the Salty Pimp, which mm-hmm. is vanilla ice cream that we inject with dulce de leche, then salt and put into chocolate dip. And the way that came about was I was, you know, using a squeeze bottle to just sort of drip dulce de leche onto everything. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute, it's got like a needle point. I could just shove it right into the ice cream.
Right.
And there I went. And I don't really know of anyone who screwed with soft serve like that at the time. I don't really know anyone now who does it. But the idea was to mangle it. Kind of. We have a cone called American Globs.
Right.
And it's busted up pretzel pieces that are smashed into the ice cream and then, again, chocolate dipped. So we really, really abuse soft serve.
And that came out of Neil Gaiman.
Yeah. I got word that he was coming to the truck and I sort of panicked and I actually wanted to name something for him.
For one of his books.
Yeah. Well, I didn't even know at the time what it would be. And I panicked and I thought, oh, wait. I'm at Union Square. There's that great pretzel vendor over there. Go get me busted up pretzels. And we're going to call it American Globs,
right
after American Gods. And that was kind of it. So the very first, Brian and I made one and tested it. But the very first American Globs served to the public was served to Neil, which is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the book, because I think this is a trip, this book. You created it to be a yearbook of sorts with the sections of freshman and sophomore and junior and senior, and you have some pretty heavy-duty endorsements in there. There's Tony Bourdain, Rachel Ray, Gail Simmons. How did this come about?
Well, we were approached by Random House, and they said, we really want you to do a book. So we went into a hyperbaric chamber and dreamed up this concept, because the main conceit of this book is that most ice cream cookbooks start with the very hardest thing first. They start with making a custard.
Right.
And it's kind of intimidating, mm-hmm. I think, for a lot of people. So we decided to do it backwards. So the very first recipes aren't really recipes. They're just fun things you can do with ice cream.
Right.
And eventually, through the course of the book, hopefully you get the cojones to go ahead and make our ice cream recipes. But if you don't get that far, there's still stuff to do.
Yeah, right from the very beginning.
Yeah, a lot of cookbooks people just sort of look at. Yeah. They're like Pinterest now, and we wanted it to be practical. And we've kind of gotten some knocks in reviews about that. Just the fact that it starts off simple, people don't really seem to get. Whatever.
Well, Douglas, it was a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much.
It really was a pleasure having me on. You're right.
It was.
Ta-ta.
Douglas Quint is co-author with Brian Petroff of Big Gay Ice Cream. David Leet is the publisher of Leet's Culinaria at lccooks.com. Well, Douglas left us with two recipes, milk chocolate ice cream and awesome sauce. And you can find them both at splendidtable.org. Coming up, priest stranglers and other Italian curiosities. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Could the dumpling be the savior of the season's overflowing CSA boxes and farmers' market sacks? Now, I'm not talking about Asian or German or Jewish dumplings. I'm talking Italian dumplings. This is what Portland chef Jen Lewis was tracking on her research trips to Italy. But when she'd ask Italian cooks about dumplings, the response was, "Dumplings are Chinese, not Italian." Jen's book, Pasta by Hand, reveals that maybe those Italian cooks got it wrong. Sally Swift got the story.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Sally. Thanks for having me back.
So, you spent a lot of time in Italy talking to people about dumplings. Tell me about that.
I did. I was lucky enough to cook with people in their homes and restaurant kitchens. And every step of the way, I kind of explained what I was doing and what I was researching. And every time I'd say, hey, I'm writing a book about Italian dumplings, they'd look at me every time and shake their heads and say, no, 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 that's Chinese food. Dumplings are Chinese food.
And yet every region has some form of pasta in that simple shape, correct?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting because Italy's 100 years younger than the U.S. as a unified country. So a lot of their foods aren't – they don't look for similarities. They look for differences mm-hmm. because their regionality is so important to them. But when you look at handmade, doughy, nubby, you know, sometimes they're baked, sometimes they're simmered. There's this very rustic, very, very, you know, food of the poor that they're making with their hands, and they're all dumplings of some sort based on their regionality.
And you define a dumpling as, I'm going to read this from the book, handcrafted nubs of dough that are poached, simmered, baked, or sautéed.
Exactly.
That sounds like gnocchi to me.
It is. And so you think about it as all gnocchi are dumplings, but not all dumplings are gnocchi.
That's interesting. So dumplings, I mean, gnocchi, I don't even know how to refer to them now, actually. But essentially, these simple pastas are created with things that you have. So tell me some of the things you can use to make a dumpling.
Well, it has to do with regionality. So you think of in the north, the Dolomites, it's really cold in the winter. In the old days, they'd make bread 4 times a year mm-hmm. in communal ovens, and they would eat it fresh, dry it out, and then they'd have these dried crumbs to use all winter. So they would make their dumplings canederli or strangolapreti out of breadcrumbs. Maybe they'd have a little bit of pork, or at the end of fall or early spring, a little bit of greens to add to it, or chestnuts, and those would be their dumplings. In the middle of the country, you know, think of Tuscany, right? Very mm-hmm. temperate. They make more of their dumplings out of potato or ricotta. And you know, there's so many varieties. They're utilizing what they have, lots of greens, zucchini, et cetera. And in the south, their production, their growing season is really long. And their dumplings are based out of semolina as their, you know, doughy nub.
Mm-hmm. Leafing through this book, I am struck by how many different things you can use to make gnocchi. You have... Just flipping through, just looking at photos, you have greens, you have spinach, you have chard, you can use collards, you can use sweet potatoes, you can use squash, you can use zucchini, you can do potato, you can do ones based on ricotta and breadcrumbs. Can you talk us through one of your favorites?
Which one? You know, I love these. The joke was every time when I was recipe testing, every time I would test another one, I'd be like, oh, this is my favorite. And the next one was, oh my gosh, this is my favorite.
All right, really I'm going to pick one because okay, it's one that people cannot resist. It's a pasta called Priest Stranglers.
Yes. Right? Strozza Pretti.
Okay, tell us how to make this. Now, anyone can make this. This is a very, very simple pasta.
It is, and it's one of my favorites, absolutely. I make this at almost every dinner that I a pasta dinner I do. So Strozza Pretti means priest stranglers, and there's lots of stories that go along with it. My favorite is that somebody had the priest over for dinner on a Sunday afternoon, and they made these, and they were so delicious, and the priest was so gluttonous, he ate as many as he could really fast and choked. And that's one of many, many stories. But these are really wonderful. They're ricotta and blanched greens, and of course you'd use whatever you have. This is not something that is a specific green. You might use spinach or kale or beet greens or chard. Whatever you have. Mm-hmm. So it's really simple. You need a bowl and a spoon. And that's one of those crazy things. This is all a simple process. You blanch kale, chop it up pretty fine, and you stir it with some eggs into ricotta, some nutmeg, a little bit of breadcrumbs, and you're making almost like what's the interior of a ravioli. Okay, so it's wet, it's really moist, and you're going to take a little bit like maybe walnut-sized pieces, little round pieces, and roll it in flour on a heavily floured sheet tray. And it's going to, as you roll it around, it's going to pick up that flour, and you're going to let it sit in your fridge for just a little bit, maybe an hour or two. And as you flip it around, maybe a couple more times as it sits, the moisture from the inside is going to bleed onto the outside and make the flour stick to the filling. And then you have almost like when you cook it, it's almost like a thin noodle wrapping around the filling.
And when you cook them, are you doing this in boiling water like you would pasta, or is it a different temperature?
I boil these. Actually, I never boil anything. I simmer these gently. You want to have some action, is what I tell my cooks. You want to see the bubbles moving. You want some action, but not rapidly because it's too vigorous for these tender dumplings. So you want some action in your water, and you put them in, give it a gentle stir, and when they start to bob, they're pretty much done. And I finish them with some melted butter with a little bit of sage, sometimes a nice aged balsamic, just a little drizzle over the top.
How delicious. And I think this is perfect summer eating. We have all this produce this time of year. It's just perfect.
Agreed.
Thanks, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
Chef Jen Lewis is author of Pasta by Hand and chef at Lincoln Restaurant in Portland, Oregon. Find her recipe for Strozza Pretti, those pre-stranglers, on the website, splendidtable.org. Wine in China, it's treated by today's wine folk as something that's proof of how westernized China's become. But how about the wine that was being drunk in China at least 1,000 years before Christ? Well, Keith Wilson is curator of the exhibit Ancient Chinese Jades and Bronzes. It's at the Freer Gallery of Art at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. In that exhibit, you'll discover some fantastical wine vessels. Keith, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So wine in ancient China, now it's probably very different from our idea of wine today. How early was this, and when and where?
Well, Chinese are certainly fermenting grains already by the Stone Age. The vessels that are on display in the Freer are generally made around the period between 1200 and 1000 BCE. So a bit later than the Stone Age. They represent a variety of shapes, and we think that the different shapes probably reflect the ritualization of alcohol consumption, because the vessels were used for very highly organized ceremonial banquets that were offered actually to deceased ancestors. First of all, I should say something about the meaning of wine. That the word is so broad, but to make sure that listeners understand that this isn't a fruit-based, especially not a grape-based wine like mm-hmm. is the most common today in the West. In Chinese antiquity, it most likely was fermented grains, and therefore we should think of it more kind of on parallel with something like sake,
uh-huh.
which is distilled rice wine. But they were also using millet and sorghum, other kinds of grains. They were probably made shortly before the event itself, and the presentation of the ritual and the use of the wine in that context apparently involved a number of different steps, because we have different shapes of containers that seem to be involved in the ritual. They were wine buckets, in many cases with lids, so we know that they were probably used to store the wine before uh-huh. the event, the lid helping to keep the liquid free of impurities. And often these containers with lids have bale handles, like a pail. So we can imagine that they were made to actually carry the wine to the event. Then there are large tripods, vessels that have three legs, generally with a spout. These seem to have been made for warming the wine. So again, very different from our concept of wine consumption today. And then service vessels, cups of various shapes and sizes. The ritual itself would begin with offerings to the deceased. And the offerings were both liquid, alcohol,
right.
and food. And then after the spirits had been fed, so to speak, the participants, the officiants in the ritual itself would probably have consumed the things that had been offered to the spirits.
So who would have been performing these ceremonies? Who would have partaken of them?
Our best guess is that rituals like this were based on clan groups. The vessels themselves being made out of very precious materials, they would have been extremely prized commodities, and so it may have been that elders actually officiated at the event itself. China, even then, was very much a society based on filial piety, that's respect for elders. And so one can imagine that they would have been the officiants.
Some of these vessels that you have illustrated, they're in the shape of fantastical animals. The detail is also really striking.
Yeah. The pieces that we're talking about are all cast bronze. Many of them are quite heavy, anywhere from, say, 5 to 15 pounds, and that's without the liquid inside.
My.
Even though they may not be massive in scale, they are kind of monumental in feeling. Generally, the outsides of the vessels are completely decorated, often with symmetrically organized frontal masks that look a little bit like an animal you're looking at head-on. Often the primary elements of those designs, the eyes, the horns, the snout, the mouth, are raised slightly in relief above the surface of the vessel
uh-huh.
with very fine background patterns, so that there's a kind of texturing that helps to offset the pattern on the surface.
These are works of art.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a friend of mine says no Chinese object was ever intended to be on display in a museum. Chinese objects are very functionally inspired. But because the particular pieces that we're talking about today are just so remarkable, they've been treasured and collected in China for centuries and in the West, certainly for the last 150, 200 years.
Keith, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Keith Wilson is curator of the Ancient Chinese Jades and Bronzes exhibit at the Smithsonian's Freer Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said it look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time for us to connect Get to us any way you want, Facebook, Twitter, actually by phone, 800-537-5252. Haley's on the line, and she's calling from Westminster, Maryland. Haley, where's Westminster, Maryland?
Westminster, Maryland is kind of, I believe it's northwest, I believe, in Maryland. It's like 18 to 20 miles outside of Baltimore.
Oh, okay. Got an image in my head. So what do you want to talk about?
So this summer, I've been really wanting to get in shape, and one of the things that I love eating is salads. But I was wondering if you had any good summer salad recipes that you would recommend.
Oh. my mother was part rabbit. We had salad every single night. Okay. First of all, anything can become a salad. So any vegetable that catches your eye, cucumbers, any kind of fruit with cucumbers is absolutely delicious, especially melon. Cucumbers and melon are just wonderful, just with a little bit of oil, vinegar, and black pepper, believe it or not. Or you can go the other direction. Grated ginger and a mixture of soy sauce and a little sesame oil, a tad of sugar. Okay, so it's an Asian-style dressing. Broccoli stems cut in sticks and just drop them in some boiling water until they're just tender. You don't want them too crunchy. And then you toss that with those little red-skin potatoes that start coming in that you've, again, boiled or you've roasted and you've sliced in half. And then what you do is you take sour cream and buttermilk and fresh lemon juice and every green herb you can think of, throw it in a food processor with some onion, let it rip, and then drizzle that over it. Put it on a bed of something like curly endive.
That sounds delicious.
And remember, there is no nut that does not taste good in a salad.
Yeah.
Nuts. You want always a salad has to have soft. It has to have crunch. It has to have just the right balance of acid and something mellow, whether it's something like the soy sauce and the sesame oil or it's olive oil. And remember, there's walnut oil. There's almond oil. There is hazelnut oil. All of these oils have wonderful flavor. Oh, and one other thing that's a fabulous dressing. Take whatever fresh herb you like, and my favorite is basil, especially when the leaves are really young. Take a big handful of that. Take about a quarter to a half a cup of mellow olive oil, not sock'em, rock'em, really bitter. And puree that together with salt, and then puree in fresh lemon juice and black pepper.
Ooh,
and it's beautiful. And that's your salad dressing.
Okay, thank you. That sounds delicious. I'll definitely try that.
Okay, you take care. Bye. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. And, you can find us at splendidtable.org, along with a ton of incredible recipes and all kinds of other brilliant information. More of your questions coming up. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're talking to you this hour. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Charlotte, Vermont is where Doug lives. Doug, hi. What is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. We are we have a fundraising event that we're putting on with friends, and we are doing it in a gorgeous 1950s era house. And we thought we'd do a theme dinner that might represent 50s, except we want to make it edible. We have lots of little cookbooks from that era that look wonderful, but their food is horrible. So I just wonder what you would it's a wild shot. Any ideas that we should try to put together?
I'm trying to think now.
We're going to do cocktails, the classic 50s cocktails.
Those cocktails are pretty good cocktails.
Yeah, that'll ease the pain, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you can maybe even serve them in 50s size glasses, which are a third the size of what we serve now.
Right.
But, you know, all right. You know what keeps coming to my mind is pigs in blankets, those little sausages in the Bisquick dough or something like that. But you know what? Wait a second. Let's back up a second. There could be some really neat versions of some of these things, you know, where it's not done with the instant mashed potatoes. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So what would happen if you got some really good sausage?
Mm-hmm.
And you could do this ahead. You grill it or you – I love to take my sausage and I pierce it and whatever and I simmer it in red wine.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then before, you know, like an hour, I do that a day or two ahead and it's cooked through. And then what I do in the morning of a party is I'll just put it in a skillet or I'll put it under the broiler, you know, a whole bunch of them just to get them seared. And then you could cut that into sections. And if you wanted to, you could put that into a decent pastry crust and bake it.
Oh, that'd be good.
Yeah, you could do puff pastry. You could do a really good pie pastry. You could do a pastry where you add herbs to it. And by the way, I just realized doing that, you could actually roll it out, you know, do the whole thing the day ahead, bake it off early in the day and serve them at room temperature.
Oh, sure.
So it's sort of a very classy pig in a blanket kind of thing. The other thing is, oh, boy, let me think now.
Jell-O molds, but
although you could do a Jell-O mold, you could get one of the really, you know, those big Jell-O molds that are all in layers, and and you could do homemade Jell-O. You could do homemade Jell-O with things like pomegranate juice, which would be very sexy. Alternating that with layers of something very rich and creamy, like a semifreddo. Now, again, this is something you would do, something that would gel, okay?
Right.
But it could be the whipped cream, the Italian meringue, and a puree of raspberries or just vanilla because it would be so delicious that way. So you would have a clear layer of the Jell-O and then you would have this creaminess that you've put gelatin in so it will firm up as well. You know what? Think about the filling of a key lime pie.
Yeah.
That could be the base, and then you could have the Jell-O and, you know, the homemade – just use pomegranate juice with gel and then something on top that's another creamy thing or, you know, similar, and you'd be off and running. I mean, that would be kind of a hoot, and it would taste pretty darn good.
Right, and it can be done ahead, so that's fine.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it can be sitting in the refrigerator for a couple of days. There's no big deal about that. And, you know, one of the other things that keeps coming to mind are those – everybody had chafing dishes, from what I understand, and they had grape jelly meatballs.
I know, yeah.
But there is nothing wrong with doing little meatballs, roast them in the oven so you're not browning them in a pan and losing your mind, in like a wine sauce. Or it could be in a sweet sour sauce, an Asian kind of thing. And that would be delicious and it would really be good food. And that could go out in a big platter and everybody kind of takes them with a little bit of toothpick or something like that. So that's another thing. And then a huge salad and you could make homemade jarred dressings.
Right.
Get dressing bottles, empty them out, rinse them out, and then put your own homemade dressings in them. And everybody dresses their salad. So you can kind of spoof a bit about all of those foods from that era.
Perfect. And maybe a roasted chicken to be the main course.
Yeah. I think you're on a good track with all of that.
Thank you so very much.
You are welcome.
And I'm getting hungry.
I have to say I am too. Enjoy the party. It sounds like it's going to be great fun.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
You take care. Bye.
Yep. Bye now.
Let's see. We've got April calling from Holly Springs, Georgia. April, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. Thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I love having a garden, and we're growing lots of vegetables and herbs, more than I can, you know, eat.
Right.
So we want to put some of them up, and I've read a couple different ways to put herbs, you know, to preserve them, and I'm not sure which is the best. I tried one for blanching, but I think it just takes all the flavor right out. So
I'm with you. I haven't figured out the reason for that. But mm-hmm. my favorite way of keeping herbs is freezing them.
Okay.
And what I do is I wash them on the branch, and I dry them, rolled up in paper towel, or just let them on, you know, put them on a drain board or someplace where they can just hang out and naturally mm-hmm. dry. And then things like rosemary and thyme, I freeze right on the branch because okay. I can pull out branches or I can strip leaves very easily. Basil, marjoram, oregano, tarragon, that kind of thing, I generally do a bit of plucking. Mm-hmm. And so,
okay, yeah.
yeah, and just want the leaves dry, and you want a good, you know, heavy duty plastic bag or some kind of sealed container, and then you stuff the bag, and then mm-hmm. I kind of flatten it out because I break off what I need, so I just flatten it out, give it a good seal, get all the air out, and freeze it, and I try okay. to freeze it flat because then. It's like having a folder. I can file it. I can tuck it against the side of the freezer or whatever. And I label the bag, and okay. that way I know what I've got. And that'll hold for a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, it's going to be dark. You know, it's going to be mushy. Mm-hmm. But 90% of the time, I'm using it in things where it's cooked in or it's added at the last minute, and that would happen anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. We also have some dill that we're growing for pickles. Do you have any suggestions for pickles?
Well,
we really like doing the refrigerator way because they're much more crisp than actually putting them all in a water bath after.
Well, yeah, and it gets, I you know, there's so many ways you can pickle. My favorite, I love sweet pickles, mm-hmm. but the technique still remains more or less the same. And mm-hmm. I'm a great fan of the icebox pickle as well. And there's a recipe on the site. I think it's called Lois Lee's Icebox Pickles. And they are sweet pickles, and they're very easy to do. But it's always the same basic thing. Mm-hmm. You make a brine with or without sugar, but it always has salt in it. And it always has usually vinegar.
Yeah.
And you simmer that with the spices you like. Now, for me, the dill goes in last. The dill isn't cooked into the brine. But you bring the brine to a boil. You then have washed whatever you're going to pickle, cucumbers, mm-hmm. green beans. And what I do is I toss them with ice cubes. And for every, let's say, pound a vegetable, I will throw in a teaspoon and a half or so of salt, a teaspoon and a half of something like kosher salt or sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
And I just let that sit in a colander in a sink. I leave it for an hour or two. And then I rinse
it. And that'll make them more crisp.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then what I do is I have sterile jars. I pack mm-hmm. them into sterile jars, and I pour the hot brine into that. And then the dill goes in, and a very generous amount of it. And the dill's been washed, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the ways that you can do it. Now, there are so many wonderful pickling recipes out there at this point.
Yeah.
And by the way, just one tip. My mm-hmm. favorite way of preserving tomatoes is in the freezer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because the skin slips off really easily, if you care about that. And yeah, they get mushy, but you, mm-hmm. you know, again, get all the air out of it, and the flavor stays so true. It's just fabulous. And you don't have to go through all of that business of, you know, the canning and the water bath mm-hmm. and da-da-da. Anyway.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, April. Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye.
800-537-5252. We've got Sharon calling from Superior, Wisconsin. Sharon, what's up? What's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I just have a question about cooking with garlic.
Oh, yeah?
And I noticed in a lot of the recipes that call for garlic, some of them call for you to chop it with a knife, you know, mince it.
Right.
And some call for you to put it through a garlic press or even just crush it with the back of a knife. But does how you prepare the garlic really make a difference? I mean, why are certain recipes calling for certain ways to prepare the garlic?
This is sort of one of those things, you know, let me count the ways that you can handle garlic. Okay. If you use a garlic press, you break it down a great deal. It's how can I put this? It is a garlic paste by the time it comes out of the garlic press. And much of its oils and its chemicals are released.
Okay.
And that will burn easily, okay? But it's a neat way to get your garlic. If you want your garlic to express all of itself, that's the way you would do it.
Okay.
If you mince it and leave it in, you know, quarter-inch pieces even, and then put it in a skillet with olive oil, a bit of water, and salt and pepper, and cover it. And you want to cook it over low heat. And you might have to take 10, 15 minutes. You want to cook it until the garlic pieces are absolutely soft. You can just take the back of the spatula, press down, and they're like cream. What you're going to get there is oil that has garlic flavor in it and bits of garlic that will just melt in your mouth, and they'll be mellow. Scoop out the garlic with a slotted spoon and put it aside. And sometimes I have bigger pieces just because they don't burn. You don't want to ever burn garlic. If you brown garlic, really brown it, it will turn bitter. Anyway, then I use that oil. I cook off the liquid, and that oil is what I saute in or do the rest of my recipe in. And then the garlic goes back in at the last moment. So that's the mellowest way to handle it. Other than cooking it in its skin. When you cook it in its skin, whether it's roasted or it's cooked in liquid of some kind in a stew or soup, what happens is you can pop out that creamy, now creamy clove of garlic, and it's as mellow as can be, and it tastes wonderful. That's the roasted garlic that people spread on bread and that kind of thing. So if you now, when you want to have the flavor of the garlic, the full flavor of the garlic, but you're going to cook it very briefly and then add liquid, you would use the garlic press.
Okay.
When you mince it, you're coming close to that. And whenever a recipe says, put the garlic and onion in the pan with hot oil and brown it, X that out. You want to put the onion in the pan and brown it, and then stir in the garlic and only cook it for a few moments. Otherwise, you're going to have terrible bitterness. Is that clear? I realize I took you around a lot of circles there.
No. You've made it clear.
Some people, you know, knock the garlic press, but I think the garlic press is really handy.
It is.
Yeah, and smashing the clove of garlic, you know, putting the flat knife blade on the clove of garlic and slamming it with your hand, that will smash the garlic, and then a lot of people will do that. They'll put salt on the cutting board, put the garlic clove on top, smash it into the salt, and the salt tends to help it break down, and then they'll mince, or they'll use the side of the knife to make a paste. Personally, a garlic press will do all of that for you, but when I'm teaching cooking and there's the overhead mirror, it's so much fun to show off and do that.
I bet. I bet it is.
Yeah. So there's the shadings of garlic for you.
Okay. No, that's great. Well, you did answer my question.
Okay. Thanks for a great question.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Maggie is on the line from Vermont. Maggie, welcome. What is on your mind?
I would like to get your opinion on the best way to make Mexican crema.
Ooh, that's tricky, because what I'm tempted to say is the best way to make it is to mix something like buttermilk with heavy cream. You want that tart edge. It's rather like doing creme fraiche, French creme fraiche. You can also do sour cream with a bit of buttermilk. But naturally cultured sour cream, not sour cream with 4 million ingredients, you know, that have very little to do with a cow. So those are two ways of doing it, and I would mix them together, you know, whether it's the buttermilk with the heavy cream or the buttermilk with the sour cream, and then let it stand at room temperature for about 12 hours and then refrigerate it. And that's going to get you pretty close.
Great.
Yeah. And let me tell you, if it's not close enough, you're going to love eating it anyway.
Yeah, you can't argue with any of those ingredients.
Right. And you put that on corn, and you roll the corn in fresh ground chili, like, you know, ancho or guajilla, and then Parmigiano cheese. We call it drippy Mexican corn because you have to eat it bending at the waist. But it's the
and
best.
And you do that after you grill it or before?
You grill it. You grill it first, or you even boil it. But grilling is wonderful. You grill it first, and then you roll it in the cream, and then you sprinkle it generously with the chili and the Parmesan.
Fantastic.
And you will just plots. It's so good.
I am just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing at all. That's, by the way, a nice combination on potatoes, spinach.
The list Everything. Goes.
Yeah, you name it. Yeah,
Anything
eggplant, you name it. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Now, remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Well, that's our show for this week. It was good to have you with us. See you next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Napoleon, who said, "In victory, you deserve champagne. In defeat, you need it." SplendidTable.org has everything you will ever need. And if you like what you heard today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.